Okay, so thank you everybody for being here on a Friday afternoon. I'm Valérie André. I'm a senior lecturer in British studies in the Department of British and American Studies here in Aix-en-Provence. I'm going to introduce our guest speaker today, Philip Ryecroft, and obviously I first want to thank him for his presence here today and extend the warmest welcome to Aix-en-Provence. So I particularly want to thank Philip for sharing what we could describe as invaluable insight into the unfolding Brexit saga. And we're going to learn a lot, I think, this afternoon. So Philip was present at the beginning, we could say. He served as Director General in the Deputy Prime Minister's Office from 2012 to May 2015. He was also head of the UK Governance Group in the Cabinet Office from June 2015 to March 29, and he advised ministers on devolution and the Constitution as head of the UK Governance Group. He was also appointed Permanent Secretary at the Department for Exiting the EU in 2017 until March 2019. And Philip, you've just taken up a position as a Distinguished Honorary Researcher at the Bennett Institute for Public Policy at the University of Cambridge. So thank you again for being here. And before listening to Philip, I want to make a few introductory preliminary comments about Brexit, obviously. The title of Philip's talk is Brexit in the United Kingdom, What is the Future? So I decided that I would focus on the past and also on the current political situation and leave the future to Philip. So I will say a few words about the current political crisis, and in a second part I will try to concentrate on the issue of the constitutional crisis. So the first point which I want to make is that there are multiple echoes of the past in the current political situation in the United Kingdom. And in particular, it's interesting to look for echoes of the first referendum on Britain's Britain's continued membership of the EEC in 1975. So there was a first referendum 2 years after Britain joined the EU, or the EEC at the time, in 1973. And this referendum was under a Labour government. The Prime Minister at the time was Harold Wilson. So what is interesting about this first referendum is that from the Prime Minister's point of view at the time, it was perhaps not so much about the European community, not so much about Britain's membership of the European community, perhaps more about the internal dynamics of the Labour Party at the time. And we have this first instance of a Prime Minister using the European question, between inverted commas, from a party political point of view, with one goal, which was to try and head off the challenge to his leadership from within the ranks of the Labour Party and the Labour government. So this first referendum was won by the Labour government at the time. The Prime Minister, Harold Wilson, and his team were in favour of continued membership, and they won this first referendum. But what is more interesting is that the attempt to try and establish a firm grip over the party was not as successful, perhaps, as Wilson might have hoped at the time. And the split within the Labour Party was not was simply postponed, and it took place a few years later when the Gang of Four, and it was the name given to the four Labour ministers who defected from Labour and formed a new party, the Social Democratic Party. So it was a split postponed. So I think that to a certain extent, of course, the situation was reproduced in 2016 or from 2012 onwards when David Cameron decided to call for a referendum on EU membership. The move was largely tactical on the part of the Conservative Prime Minister. The goal was to solve a problem within the Conservative Party using popular arbitration, using the referendum, the consultation of the public, to solve an internal problem within the Conservative Party. We could also say that perhaps David Cameron tried to find an appropriate response to the pressure exercised by the UK Independence Party at the time. In 2015, the UK Independence Party, so challenging the Conservatives from a radical right, anti-European perspective, in 2015, the UK Independence Party won 12.2% of the national vote at the general election, representing a real threat for the Conservatives on the right. So my point, of course, here is that in both cases, Europe, the European question, was instrumentalized for party political reasons, and the European question played into party politics, ideological divisions within the parties, perhaps between the parties as well, but also within the parties. As far as the fissile effect of the European question is concerned, so how far it can lead to a fragmentation within the parties and fragmentation of the political system, I just want to remind you of a few developments which took place after the 2016 referendum in Britain. On the right, first of all, on the right of the political spectrum, the referendum has led to a number of clash of the conservative tribes. We've witnessed the rise of factionalism in Parliament with the formation of the European Research Group. We've seen the emergence of splinter groups, however short-lived they were, like the Independent Group, for instance, the cross-party group of MPs who crossed the floor. Purges as well, with 21 Conservative members of Parliament having the whip removed by Boris Johnson in September of 2019. This is also true on the left, with Labour becoming embroiled in its own quarrels, internal feuds, and the latest development is the decision taken by the deputy leader, Tom Watson, to step down, mainly because, of course, he probably rejects the party line, or at least the leader's line on European questions, in particular on the European question. So the effect of Brexit has been to, ironically, we could say, Europeanize the British political landscape, which has moved away from a sort of, you know, binary political landscape to a situation where today debate, the political debate which is taking place, is taking place between four major players. The next general election, which is going to be taking place on the 12th of December, can be described as a four-party race. And this will be my perhaps first question to Philip. The question being, to what extent he thinks that this realignment is temporary or permanent? First question that I want to ask. Before moving on to the second part of my short presentation today, which concerns the constitutional crisis. And so, as far as the constitution is concerned, I think that there are a number of signs which can point to what we could describe as a constitutional crisis in Britain today. So the first point which I want to raise is that in the campaign leading up to the 2016 referendum, the constitutional debate on UK-EU relations was always reduced to questions surrounding the notion of sovereignty. It was the big question, the take back control aspect of the campaign and the debate in 2016. So an emphasis on sovereignty issues, irrespective of other pressing issues which could have been raised from a constitutional point of view. So, ironically, in view of the standard criticisms of the EU by Brexiters, traditional advocates of Brexit, the standard criticism being that the EU is over-centralised, that the EU confiscates power, that it lacks accountability. The last 3 years since 2016 have seen Conservative government make extensive use of royal prerogatives. Now, this is allowed under the EU Withdrawal Act 2018, but nevertheless, the British government, Theresa May's government, first of all, and then Boris Johnson since the July 2019, have been using what is generally referred to as the Henry VIII powers, or Henry VIII clauses. Boris Johnson has attempted to prorogue Parliament for 5 weeks, and what we have is a multiplicity of signs of executive dominance which has resulted in repeated clashes with anti-Brexit campaigners and the legislature. Other signs of a constitutional breakdown or constitutional crisis: the former speaker whose impartiality has been called into question on a number of occasions. I want to quote here perhaps the Telegraph. He described the former speaker as transforming the role he inherited from one of studied neutrality to that of an active participant, so questioning his impartiality. We could also mention the fact that the Queen has been dragged into the political fray. The last Queen's speech could be described as a party political broadcast in disguise. Okay. Second point that I want to make concerning the constitutional disorder on the other side of the channel, and this has to do with the clash, the incompatibility of the logic of direct and indirect democracy, which we've been witnessing since the referendum of 2016. It seems to me that members of parliament have been trying to, perhaps unsuccessfully, reconcile direct democracy and parliamentary democracy, unsure of where their loyalties should lie when they had to implement the result of the referendum in contradiction with their own perception of the country's interest. The majority of MPs had voted in favour of Remain at the time of the 2016 referendum. And this, of course, can go a long way to explaining the current paralysis, we could say, in the UK. So, to conclude this short introduction, I first want to say that I emphasise this question of the repatriation of powers from the EU, which is the priority of the so-called Brexiters. And this repatriation of powers from the EU has unleashed centripetal forces in the United Kingdom in a context where it is unclear where control would be taken back from and who it could be taken from, or where control would be taken back to and who it could be taken from. The traditional view of Britain's uncodified constitution is that all power rests in the Westminster Parliament. However, this is being questioned by the power of devolved parliaments and also by the power of the people through direct democracy. There are also long-standing questions about the distribution of power in Parliament, especially between the executive and the House of Commons. So as a result, Parliament's role has at times been at the heart of proceedings. At other times, it has relied on the judiciary to clarify its role, while in other times, it has been at the backdrop for a Conservative or Labour Party infighting. So there is a mix of roles which is largely reflective of the divisive nature of the Brexit debate in Britain, and which is perhaps set to continue into the foreseeable future. So we'll be looking to Philip, of course, to try and offer perspectives here for the future.
Okay.
And I want to end with one last quote taken from an article published by a colleague from the Free University of Brussels. His name is Peter Lagroux. And it's interesting because it's a European perspective on Brexit. It's depressing, but I think it's interesting. So it's a fairly lengthy quote, but if you can bear with me. So Peter Lagroux writes, "Seen from the European continent, Europe not only seems at risk to lose a valuable partner in the European experiment, an experiment that has its manifest shortcomings, but that is undeniably the only future-oriented experiment on the table today. It has already lost a model, one of political stability and liberalism, a democracy built on centuries of parliamentary tradition and representative government, so unlike the spasmodic and violent constitutional histories of the continent. Europeans have been cradled to distrust continental politics and look across the Channel and the Atlantic for political stability, liberal resilience, checks and balances. Brexit and Trump have brought a brutal awakening. The problem is no longer Europe, it is democracy itself in Washington, London, Belfast, Edinburgh, no less than in Berlin and Paris, let alone Rome, Budapest, and Warsaw." And with these words, it's